From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Southwest Florida property owners have their TRIM, or Truth in Millage, notices. Those notices estimate property taxes to be paid based on assessed value, but many people don't realize they can argue those values. The time to contest those assessments is quickly coming to a close. We'll take a look at the process and what property owners considering an appeal need to know. Plus, PBS NewsHour senior correspondent Ray Suarez joins us for a look inside his book, Latino Americans, chronicling 500 years of Latino history in the U.S. that's largely overlooked in our school history classes. The book is a companion to a PBS documentary miniseries premiering this month. We'll explore the rich history and contributions of Latino Americans, especially in Florida. First, this news.
Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Amy Tardiff. Ray Suarez set out to write the history of Latino Americans, the story of many people from many places who came together in one country to become known as one people. This week, his book, Latino Americans, The 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation, came out as a companion book to the PBS documentary series that airs on WGCU-TV on September 17th, the 24th, and October 1st. The TV series is known by the same name, Latino Americans. Suarez is a senior correspondent for PBS NewsHour and host of the public radio show America Abroad. He's hosted Talk of the Nation and reported for CNN. Ray Suarez joins us by phone to talk about his book. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thank you for being here, Ray.
Good to be with you, Amy.
And for the audience, are you a Latino American? You can call 1-877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Ray, at more than 50 million people, Latino Americans comprise the largest minority group in the U.S. Yet, as you say in your introduction, this is a group of people from far and wide who have come to be known as one people. Is there a united front?
Well, it is unlike any other group of immigrants that we've ever really tried to wrap our heads around in American history. The Irish came from a small and identifiable island off the coast of Europe. The Italians came from a group of countries that became one country, but it is a language region of southern Europe, and they came during a specific and identifiable point of time. The people who now refer to themselves as Hispanics or Latinos or Latin Americans come from two dozen countries over the course of centuries, and it's really life here, not where they come from, that makes them into something like one ethnic group. It's a really paradoxical situation. They're also the only immigrant group that was already here before there was an America, and then came to the United States in later years. So a very old deposit in this continent and a renewing population all in the same moment.
And are there as many cultures as countries blended into that one name?
Yes, but once you arrive here, it's life here that starts to shape you. So you become a hybrid of who you were when you got on the plane, got on the boat, and life here. So the Spanish language, Spanish television, politics, the issues that face these communities. I mean, a crummy school in the South Bronx that's got mostly Dominican and Puerto Rican students is different in some ways, but faces some of the same challenges in essential ways to a school in L.A. Unified School District that's filled with Mexican-Americans, or a Miami-Dade school that's filled with Cubans or Central Americans, Venezuelans. The challenges of access to the political system, of the right to a good education, equal access to housing. Those things are pretty similar, whether you're in San Antonio or Chicago.
Why do you say the history of Latino Americans also should be considered everyone in the U.S.'s history?
I hope that people will give this book a chance and take a look at it. It's an easy read. It's I think an exciting read, and they will find where the gears of this story mesh with the gears of their own understanding of American history. They will take on new information that fits in very easily with what they already know about America. We tend to tell a story of American history that starts on the East Coast with English people in Jamestown, Virginia, and in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and then over centuries moves west from that East Coast. We don't tell a multi-regional, multi-coastal, multi-empire story that has three big European empires throwing out their elbows and pushing up against each other, France, Britain, and Spain, all vying for dominance on this continent. Eventually, one of those empires kind of wins the argument culturally, and we have an Anglo-American political system and a culture heavily affected by our roots in Anglo-America, but also shaped by that Spanish heritage here in the New World, in what is now the 50 United States. So I think it won't, you know, overturn everything you ever knew about American history, but it'll just hopefully persuade you to look at it in a different way. American history is Latino history. Latino history is American history. It's not some separate discipline off by itself somewhere else.
This is a discussion we've had in our own newsroom. To clarify, what people identify as Latinos? Is it anyone whose homeland was once occupied by Spain? And if that's true, then Canadians are Latinos. But is that also why Brazilians are not?
I think the most commonly understood self-definition among people who call themselves that is having a heritage that traces back to the Spanish Empire in the New World. There are pedantic, nitpicky people who say, "Oh well, that means Italians are because they speak a Latinate language. They speak a Romance language. They're Latinos, and French are Latinos." Well, they're not, and we know that. And it's in common parlance when you ask people who are, they will give you a rough and ready definition that may not pass muster with a sociologist, but it's definitely something that's well understood by the people who describe themselves that way. And they don't think Italians are who they're talking about.
What led you to write the book?
Well, I had been shopping book proposals with New York publishers, and then the 2010 census came out and counted more than 50 million Latinos in the country, and people started to sit up and take notice of that number. And then the producers of the PBS documentary series approached me and asked me if I'd be interested in writing the companion volume and helping them plan the series. And the timing seemed great. I was looking for a new project, and there it was, falling right into my lap. But then once I started, I realized how much I thought I knew and how much I really didn't know about this history. So it's been great fun doing the research, doing the background, and trying to turn it into a story that makes sense. You know, it covers vast territory and a vast chunk of time. And to make it hang together as a story, you have to keep some things in mind, what people already know, what they're taking on that's new, and how to make it all fit.
Our guest is Ray Suarez, host, correspondent, and author of the new book, Latino Americans, which is a companion to the upcoming PBS documentary series of the same name. Our phone number is 1-877-GCU-TALK. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Florida is among 21 states in which Latinos are the largest minority group, according to the U.S. Census, housing more than a million Hispanic residents in 2012. So, Ray, please point out the irony of Florida's involvement in how its Latinos are both the oldest and the youngest of its residents.
Yeah, it's interesting that history has dealt Florida the particular set of cards that it's played with in the 20th and 21st century, where you have fights over the role of Spanish in society, the role of Spanish in government, when Spanish was quite obviously and quite well known to be the first European language spoken in Florida and the dominant language for centuries. When you walk the streets of the old section of St. Augustine, you are communing with Spanish history in the New World. When Ponce de Leon was tromping around Florida and planting the Spanish flag, he probably couldn't have imagined a time when people would have been yelling at each other over whether it was okay to speak Spanish. So, yes, the historical trends of the 20th century, Cold War, and problems in the rest of the political problems, economic problems in the rest of the hemisphere, all had their effect on the modern history of Florida. But even the name Florida, you know, the flowery place, goes back to the earliest European presence in the Western Hemisphere.
And yet, I'm also curious about how a U.S.-occupied Puerto Rico, what that means for its people, what does it mean today, including?
You know, Puerto Ricans are, in many ways, accidental Americans. The war between Spain and the United States at the end of the 19th century was fought largely over Cuba, over whether Cuba would remain part of the Spanish Empire, whether the aspirations of independence groups on the island would finally be satisfied. They had been struggling both inside and outside Cuba for decades to get Spain out. And Cuba became a cause on the American mainland. Puerto Rico was never any of those things. And in Washington, as they worried over the short war that was fought against Spain, nobody really thought about what to do with Puerto Rico. Nobody thought about what would happen to it after the war. And yet, the Stars and Stripes went up. American agricultural interests wrestled over how to incorporate Puerto Rico into the system of selling of commodities. So there were a lot of conversations about coffee and bananas and sugar, but no conversations about people. They were people of a totally uncertain, ambiguous status until a woman named Isabel Gonzalez takes her case all the way to the Supreme Court to insist on the right of Puerto Ricans as people living under the American flag to move to the mainland with as little problem as a Georgian might move to Virginia or somebody from New Jersey might move to Michigan. It took a Supreme Court case until 1917 when, by an act of Congress, Puerto Ricans become American citizens, and that takes away at least a little bit of the ambiguity. But that accidental status has followed the island and its people for most of the century since.
Tell us a bit about Emilia Castañeda, who was born in the U.S., yet she was still deported to Mexico during the Depression.
You know, the rising panic over the widespread job loss and economic crisis that accompanied the Depression finally got to the point where the Secretary of Labor told people in the Southwest to start deporting Mexicans. But in the roundups and widespread deportations, hundreds of thousands of people, also swept up were naturalized people and people who, as you say, in the case of Emilia Castañeda, were born in the United States. So American citizens deported from their own country because of the lack of due process and the lack of effort in distinguishing who could stay and who could not. If you spoke to Americans in power and influence at the time, they had no doubt that Mexicans were taking jobs from real Americans, quote unquote. And so this really remarkable thing happened of people just herded onto trains and sent south. During the teeth of the Depression, the worst part of the Depression, we did not send Italians back to Italy or Poles back to Poland, but America felt very little hesitancy in rounding up Mexicans, especially in Southern California, but elsewhere in the Southwest as well, and just sending them back to Mexico. And in the case of thousands of people like Emilia Castañeda back to a place that they had actually never been.
And way back in 1942, the Bracero program, in which the U.S. and Mexican governments signed an agreement to bring 1 million temporary workers in as farm laborers, began. That agreement promised they would not be mistreated. What happened?
Well, it shows the capriciousness of America's hunger for labor. We felt we had too much of it during a depression when so many people were unemployed. And then once we enter World War II, there's a fear that there won't be enough people to pick the beets, pick the strawberries, pick the cabbage, and so on. And so agricultural workers are brought in by the thousands from Mexico. The program grows. And then once the war is over, the Bracero program is not sunsetted. So Mexican laborers become a very important link in the chain from farm to dinner table in the United States. And it causes no small amount of controversy among Mexican Americans. Even the new civil rights organization, the American GI Forum, that was begun by returning Latino servicemen after the Second World War, puts out a pamphlet called What Price Wetbacks? And discusses how the general struggle for Mexican Americans to obtain full and equal citizenship was being hindered by the presence of so many Mexican nationals who were agricultural workers who had poor health, poor education, poor housing, and were a questionable good to the United States. We have had this ambiguous feeling about whether we want these people, our people, here or back home. And it goes on to today. You know, the echoes of that fight over the Braceros, you can hear in the discussions about comprehensive immigration reform today.
And I believe that program actually ended in 1964, but the border crossings for farm labor had only just begun. And as you say, a lot of that continues today, as does the alleged mistreatment.
Even Cesar Chavez, who is thought of as a Mexican-American champion of civil rights and workers' rights, was not someone who thought that illegal immigrants should be working in the United States. It most obviously undermined his effort to ask for a living wage for those people who work in the fields, because every time he attempted to negotiate a fair hourly or piece rate for his workers, they would just bus in thousands of new workers from south of the border who would work for much less. So even Cesar Chavez questioned the presence of agricultural workers, who, of course, have also long been a feature of big ag in Florida as well.
Did the Mariel boatlift in 1980 change Americans' views of Cubans who had been coming here for decades? Did it change the view of Cubans because of who got to leave the island at that time?
Well, Mariel came at a time when the United States wasn't as confident about its economic future and things were starting to slow down. Also, the nature of the immigrants was very different as well. Fidel Castro wanted to put a thumb in the eye of the Colossus of the North, and not only said, oh, anybody who wants to leave can leave, so people started scrambling for the boats, but also cleared out prisons, hospitals, mental wards. It really was a shocking piece of international statecraft at the time, as people were pouring into South Florida, and the people who had been heroic refugees from communist depression were now suddenly filling up social welfare agencies, filling up jails waiting for arraignment. And there was a very different reception in Florida when the Marielitos started to be settled. The Cuban community, to its great credit, set up its own private voluntary agencies to process these people, but also there was a large government response. There had to be. And Jimmy Carter made aid available to Florida as well. But
and Ray, I'm sorry.
When you take on a couple of 100,000 like that, it's tough.
And I just wanted to mention, we're going to hear the Babaluai from Desi Arnaz's Ricky Ricardo, who was on the air on TV in 1951. And I'm going to tell people they have to read the book to find out why he was so special.
Yes, Babalu is featured in the book along with Desi Arnaz.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ray.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Ray Suarez is senior correspondent for the PBS NewsHour and host of the public radio show America Abroad. His new book, Latino Americans, The 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation, is a companion to the PBS documentary series of the same name. It begins airing on WGCU-TV September 17th. This Friday night, WGCU holds a preview screening and panel discussion with local Latinos at Hodges University's Hispanic Institute at 5:30. Information is at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. You can continue commenting on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. This is WGCU Fort Myers, 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida. For Richard Chinqui, Luke Martin, and John Davis, I'm Amy Tardif. Have a great afternoon.